Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week for your listening pleasure. Now, bear in mind that this show is pretty much 100% listener supported. If you are capable and you enjoy the platform that we give activists and researchers and various people from around the globe to get their messages out to people in a decent format, which is enjoyable, at least I think so, then please go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and make a donation or subscribe for a couple of dollars a month, so that way we have a regular income of which to finance this wee operation here, which we are trying to expand every day in every single way. And also, speaking of pledging and donating and what have you, do you have a website or something of that nature, Eric, where people can go to pledge and get a DVD of the documentary?
Yes, we sure do. www.druglord.com. Go there, click on the Pledge Me link, or send us a message in the contact page. We'll get back to you. We'd appreciate the support. And if you're feeling really flush, you can get a principal sponsor credit in the film for $420 or $800 for an executive producer credit, and you'll be enshrined in the halls of legend forever if you do so.
Right. Excellent. Enshrined in the halls of legend. Sounds biblical.
Well, cannabis is mentioned in the Bible, actually, in the Old Testament. You see the word kane bosem, which was mistranslated as calamus. It's obviously the word cannabis, cannabosim. When the Bible was translated and retranslated, they either made a mistake or there was a deliberate excision of the word cannabis. The early popes hated cannabis because they associated its use with their enemies and with paganism. So they had a little campaign against it, and they might have been responsible for this retranslation of the word.
And they were big drinkers of wine too, weren't they?
Yes. Again, the drug hypocrisy is enshrined in the Catholic Church. You know, Jesus turned water into wine.
And now, I think Jesus should have turned the apple tree into a massive cannabis plant or something like that, and suddenly everybody had salad.
Yes, he could have done that as well. It's interesting because some Bible scholars think that the holy anointing oil that was used to anoint Jesus, if you believe in Jesus, you know, that's a contentious subject, but if you do believe in it, well, it was likely that he was anointed with an oil containing cannabis. So, you know, Jesus used cannabis in one form or another. We don't know if he smoked it, but they were burning the oils in their ceremonies at that time, so they were getting high, even if it wasn't smoking it directly. They were getting secondhand highs from cannabis.
Okay. And weren't Bibles as well printed on hemp paper for
the very first Bible ever printed, the Gutenberg Bible, was printed on hemp paper. So there you go. Not only is cannabis in the Bible, cannabis is the Bible in some cases.
Yeah, well, it's good enough for Gutenberg. Why isn't it good enough for us?
Not only was it good enough for Gutenberg, that Bible still exists today because it was printed on such high-quality hemp paper. The scrolls of the ancient Chinese still exist today because they were printed on hemp rather than on what we use today, which is wood pulp paper, which has got a huge cost to the environment, and it's not even as good. So why are we still making paper out of trees? You can get four times the amount of paper out of the same land if you grow cannabis on that land instead of trees.
And you can harvest it multiple times a year.
Correct, and
well,
you're using a fraction of the water, the pesticides, and the herbicides.
Well, so let's extrapolate that. When you say that you can get four times as much paper out of land, yep, than you can with trees, mm-hmm, is that meaning that there's one crop of hemp versus a mature crop of trees, which takes 10 years to grow,
that's
and that
right,
one crop of hemp gets four times more paper?
No. What I'm saying is that because you can cycle cannabis on the land much more easily than trees, and its life cycle is much shorter, it's the fastest growing biomass on the planet, or one of the fastest growing biomasses. It simply means you can harvest it four times as often, or I'm not sure the exact number, but the amount of product that you can get from that land to make the paper will give you four times as much paper as if you plant trees.
Over a time frame. So for when you're planting the trees, you've got a 10-year waiting period before you even get any money back.
That's
and then
right.
a storm might happen and blow a whole bunch of them down, or there might be some kind of a forest fire, or there might be droughts or whatever. I wonder if an entire massive crop of cannabis has ever really been affected by a forest fire or anything like that. The only times I've ever seen like mass burn-offs and things like that is up north when they confiscate massive crops, and you see the... I believe there was a news reporter standing in front of it, and the smoke was wafting over him, and it was a blooper reel or something
and
like that.
He started laughing.
He started laughing, and he kept losing his place and stuff like that, trying to be professional.
Yes. Interesting that when they burn these crops, they all stand around and take deep breaths. You know, the police are often doing that. They're just enjoying the high and you know, let them. I say, well, enjoy it. At least you kind of get to be happy for that little period of your time policing this plant. You know, you're trying your best. You might be misguided, but you're trying your best.
Yeah. A friend of mine was telling me back in high school that he was watching a bunch of cops sitting there, and they just kind of slumped to the side very gently as they're standing around these big roaring fires of cannabis smoke. So, again, the hypocrisy. He was even pulled over one time, and a cop was rolling a cigarette, like with the normal cigarette papers and what have you, and there was cardboard ripped out of the cigarette papers, like people do when they're rolling their cardboard for the end of their joints and something like that. So it was very clear to him that this officer was a cannabis user, confiscated an ounce off him, didn't charge him, and just let him go.
Oh, yes.
He went right home with that ounce, didn't
yes.
he?
Oh, yes. Listen, in South Africa, I was walking down the street with my friend Ralph. These two cops, they had these yellow police cars there, or they had them at this stage. I haven't been there for a while, so I don't know what the cop cars look like now, but this yellow car pulls up, cops jump out, they start talking to us, they search Ralph, they take his weed, they drive off, they don't charge us, they don't really hassle us, they just take the weed. Carry on walking, and we see them park down the road, smoking a fucking joint. Smoking, no.
FCC regulations. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen.
You know how that. I didn't actually say it. I stopped myself at that last second. But anyway. So there you go. There you go. Policemen smoke weed probably as much as the general population. So and they have access to it. They have free access to it. They can just take it off you. They don't have to pay for it.
Now, see. And what stoner is going to go to the police station and say, these officers took my weed and they didn't charge me? Where is that weed? Where is the evidence? The officer will just say, no, we never stopped them. This kid's just making it up. And then a person will file a police complaint to the police complaints authority, and the other cops will just do nothing.
Well, I would like to see the drug testing be extended to the police force. I would like to see exactly how many of them are going to be stood down when they're found, when cannabinoids are found in their blood, and how the police force will grind to a halt. Because I reckon there's probably between 5 or 10% of people in the police force who indulge in some illicit drug use. So let's campaign to have the police force drug tested. If they want drug testing for the general population, or if the Mike Sabins of the world and Peter Dunns of the world think drug testing is fair to be forced on the rest of us, well, let's put that drug testing on the police as well.
Well, yeah, I think if you're going to test anybody, test the people who are the enforcers of the law first and the people who break the law second. Because, hey, you can't have corruption and hypocrisy running through a government, can you, if you're wanting to keep the public safe, if that's what they allege that they're doing, when they're frickin' not. Making it all worse.
Well, the main cause of corruption in the police force is the drug laws. I've spent a lot of hours in court during the production of this film, and I've met a lot of people who are up on drug charges. And I've heard stories of bags of methamphetamine being taken by the police and not registered in the evidence registry. That meth was just sold or used or what have you. I've heard of bags of drug money being taken by the police, not reported. That money was stolen. Two cases of that, including dear old great-grandmother in Pyro who had about $300 or $400 pinched by the police. Her charges were embellished. The police lie regularly to get a drug charge to stick. And it's accepted. It's accepted practice. We have Timothy Sarah, police prosecutor, found guilty of dealing methamphetamine from the courthouse. From the courthouse, between sessions in court, police prosecutors are selling methamphetamine that's been confiscated from crime scenes. What a racket.
Now, I also heard that the police have an intimate relationship with drugs and the gangs themselves. Do you have any evidence of that?
I've reason to believe that the raids on the Daiquiri were preempted by the police sending in gang members to cause trouble. That it seems that the police have instigated the pretext to raid the Daiquiri. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's the Daiquiri, because I'd heard stories that the police would confiscate drugs from one gang and then go across the road and sell it to the other.
It's happened before. It wouldn't surprise me. Look, I'm not saying that all policemen are corrupt, but what other opportunities do the ones who are prone to corruption have to exercise that corruption if you take the drug scene out of it? They don't really have. What can you do? You resell a stolen TV.
Yeah, I mean, there's no money. Seriously, in it. We're like taking the cookies out of the cupboard of a compulsive eater, essentially, right? There ain't nothing to compulsively eat if there ain't nothing to eat.
That's right. I mean, you can't really engage in corrupt activity in a murder case, in a rape case, in an assault case, in any number of cases that you can think of. There's no opportunity.
Unless you committed them and take steps to cover it up.
Okay, aside from covering up, but you're not going to be able to profit from it. The only real instance where you can profit from a crime is if drugs are involved and you take the money or you take the drugs, you resell, you pass it on, you give it to Timothy Sarah to resell or pass it on. So it's the opportunity that the drug laws present for corruption to occur in the police force. The main problem with our police force today.
You believe that's the main problem with the police force today?
It's, well, with regards to corruption, yes. I mean, the
certainly in the most widespread.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Both here and in almost any other country where drugs are illegal, which is everywhere.
Yeah, and hey, as we just demonstrated, everybody's got a story of police lying or being corrupt or something like that. I remember when I was arrested, they found 13 grams of cannabis on me, and they charged me with selling up to $40,000 worth of cannabis.
You were charged?
Oh, yeah. I was convicted too, man. I pled guilty and got 300 hours community service. The guy in front of me who was up for sexual assault, resisting arrest, growing 3 cannabis plants, got 150 hours community service. Explain that one to me.
Well, the logic is that if you beat someone over the head, it's a lesser crime than if you snub your nose at authority by growing a plant or possessing the dried flowers of that plant. that's the so-called logic.
It was an indictable charge for me. I was going to go to jail. I could have gone to jail for up to 8 years.
So they embellished 13 grams into $40,000.
Uh-huh.
Yes, this
because I admitted that I'd been selling for so many months. You know, I was just totally naive at the time. And so they said, oh, well, he must have been selling an ounce a week, and then therefore, and then just so on and so forth, $40,000.
Yes, yes, the classic embellishments. One of the police tricks is to take a plant that's in a pot and to measure it from the ground, including the pot, to the top, to say that the plant is an extra 25 or 35 centimeters in height. Therefore, it has a street value of X plus 35 centimeters,
yeah.
And you can then up the amount. And then, of course, each plant is a street value, according to the police, of, you know, an exponentially greater amount than its real street value. They just compound all of these numbers and they embellish the charge against you just to wreck your life a little bit more.
Well, I think it's more to get people to plead guilty to lesser charges if they make up much more massive charges. And they say, well, if you plead guilty to this charge, which you're actually guilty of, we'll drop these charges which we made up.
That's right, which brings us to the case of Stephen McIntyre. He was a cannabis activist who founded medical dispensary to help people with severe illnesses that can only be treated by cannabis or ameliorated by cannabis. The police arrested him. They harassed him mercilessly. They threatened him to drum up the charges, and if he didn't plead guilty, they kept putting pressure on him. They came to his house claiming to be checking on his bail conditions when he wasn't required to be at the house at that time, so that was another lie. And eventually the pressure got too much for him and he committed suicide. So this was a personal friend of mine, very gentle guy, lovely man, who's now dead. His children have no father, his wife has no husband, and the police have his blood on their hands. And this is happening every day. Every day in New Zealand, I've met people during the course of making this documentary. One girl whose uncle owned a cannabis cafe in the Netherlands, came back to visit his family, was arrested for a small amount of cannabis, put in a cell, had an epileptic fit, and died. So, for what? What were the police imprisoning that man for? What was he doing to anybody else? Absolutely nothing. He had some dried flowers in his pocket.
Did he deserve to die?
Definitely didn't deserve to die. He didn't deserve anything. He didn't deserve to be scolded. He didn't deserve, you know, he didn't deserve any kind of punishment whatsoever. He certainly didn't deserve to lose his life. And his family certainly didn't deserve his life to be taken from them.
See, you do realize that the drugs don't kill people. Drug laws kill people.
Absolutely.
And enforcement of the like. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. A very special guest, Arik Parees from druglord.com. That's law with a W. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
The flight to New Zealand by plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you, give me a dessert, give me a dessert, give me a dessert. Have your dessert, you prick, give me that dessert. Have a Bloody Mary, yeah, give me a whiskey sour, yeah, give me whatever you got. Just more liquor, more liquor, more liquor. And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go. You want to know what it's like? You can experience going to New Zealand. It's very simple. Sit in a chair for 19 hours and take your hands and press your head as hard as you can. And don't stop. Don't stop. 19 hours, just like this. And then at the end of 19 hours, you pull your hands off and you feel like you're in New Zealand. You certainly won't feel like you're home. They say that New Zealand's beautiful, and I don't know, because by the time I got over the jet lag, I had to go. And it seems to me, if you're going to travel for 19 hours to another country, when you get there, they should have the common courtesy to speak another language. I did not fly all this way to hear English again.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, Arik Parees from druglord.com. That's law, you know, ED, druglord.com. Now, there's a Pledge Me thingy on there, ladies and gentlemen, so if you can help him finish his film, get it out to people. I've seen what he managed to do with the High Time New Zealand documentary. And I remember saying to you at the time, it's like, oh, man, they made you butcher it. Oh, you know, it's so one way or the other, and it's so iffy, and there's things in there that just like, what are you trying to do? Balance the equation with misconception. It's just like, oh, my God, you poor bastard. And now this is going to be like, in my opinion, probably the best freaking cannabis documentary that's been made in like a decade.
I don't recall any significant documentaries being made on cannabis except for the TV3 documentary that I made back in 2010. There's been some, you know, smallish kind of TV coverage on Maori TV about it, but it hasn't really been a significant investigation. We are looking at the entire world when we look at this documentary and the microcosm that New Zealand presents, because the same laws that are in this country have been imposed by the United States on almost every country on the planet. And those laws are causing an incredible amount of harm. And they're suppressing the production of a plant that can do an incredible amount of good. So, you know, the costs to society of the prohibition of cannabis are enormous. And we need to really get past this childish, racist, anachronistic disposition against this plant. We need to grow up and realize that for 12,000 years almost, human beings have been benefiting from this plant, and it's only in the past 100 years there's been this prohibition of the plant, which has caused all of these problems, and we need to get back to what we were doing for those 12,000 years.
Mm. You know, it reminds me, I think my uncle was really drunk one night and scared a cigarette off me and proceeded to tell me that I'll never amount to anything and nobody ever amounts to anything if they use cannabis, that it's only for losers while drunk as frack.
Smoking a cigarette, exactly. Addicted to the two drugs of choice in Western society.
Have you ever seen Trainspotting, you know, in the start, it's like, oh, I don't do heroin. It's foreign fucking chemicals, you know, as he sculls back a beer and takes a puff of a cigarette, you know?
Exactly. You know, the drug hypocrisy that we've got in Western society has spread, unfortunately, to all of these societies in Asia, in Africa, South America more recently, which have been using cannabis for a longish or very long period of time. And now cannabis is being displaced. In India, it's being displaced by the use of alcohol, especially in the north of India. And alcohol is causing all kinds of problems in society. Meanwhile, the kind of shunty attitude of the cannabis user is being shunned. You know, it's being suppressed. There's widespread crop burnings. And it's not just crops being planted for recreational medicinal purposes or industrial purposes. It's crops being planted for food. So you've got this, the impact of cannabis prohibition on people's livelihood in that way. Some people are starving in Nepal because their crops are being eradicated by UN drug programs. UNESCO and so forth are in there and destroying their food, you know, so that the U.S. can say, rah, rah, our cannabis prohibition is worldwide, and so we're going to destroy this plant in any country that we find it, regardless of your sovereign rights in that country.
Yeah, and that's another thing. Not only do the laws inherently give a justification to deprive individuals of their rights, but through the United Nations, it actually globally violates national sovereignty.
Absolutely. The conventions on drugs that most countries are signatories to take away the power of those countries to organize their laws and their policies in a way that suits those countries' needs and has the most positive outcomes. So sovereignty has been flushed down the toilet by signing these conventions, and it's extremely difficult for countries to step back and go, hang on a second, we need to there's a process where you can withdraw from a convention and re-sign with conditions. And in order to find the political will for a parliament of any country, including New Zealand, to do that, it's extremely difficult. So we're in lockstep with these stupid United Nations policies.
Well, there has been was it Raglan or some other small New Zealand town who says that they wanted to start a campaign there on a small scale to legalize using a local ordinance, and that would basically crack open the door. Just kind of like, if you want something to get really big, you got to start small.
Yes, no, I know which. It was a place in the South Island. I'm sorry, I'm not sure exactly what the town is called, where one of the local councillors was pushing for this. But it's not going to find a lot of traction. There's too many conservative people in the local city councils in this country to have the foresight to realize, well, there are ways that you can do it. They did it in the Netherlands. They had the tolerance policy. They still have it to this day, where the police were told, just turn a blind eye. It's still against the law. Look the other way because it's not a problem. And then they found that not only was it not a problem, it was actually a boon. They have tourism there because of it. They have, I don't know, millions? I could say millions of people visiting every year.
Well, there's 1 million annually from France alone.
Visiting the Netherlands.
Specifically.
To visit the coffee shops.
That's a tourism boom by any stretch of the imagination. And then you think about the proximity, how many other countries are within there that are easily travelable by train. Now with the European zone, you don't even need to have passports and things checked. You just roll right in and then roll right up.
Right. And the problem associated with this is that people are going there to score and then transporting it back to their own countries. And they're being, you know, they're being arrested for that, and fair enough. Fair enough, you're taking it across national borders and you shouldn't be doing that.
That's drug trafficking.
Exactly. So I don't mind people being punished for doing stupid things with cannabis, right? They just, if you sell to somebody who's underage, you deserve to go to jail. So the problem there, though, is that you can't get it in Germany legally. You can't get it in France legally. You have to go to the Netherlands to get it. So if they were to legalize in France and in Germany, you would, that problem would disappear.
Yeah, there would be no drug trafficking over the borders for those particular people that are currently being caught for it. And also, on the other hand, I've heard that the tourism boom in the Netherlands is so strong because of this that they're actually experiencing problems because of the huge amount of tourists that they're coming in, and certain people being disrespectful.
That's right.
Defecating in the street and so on and so forth.
Well,
I'm not sure if that's to do with the cannabis, though, you know. Cannabis doesn't make me want to squat in the street.
No, no, although I have seen people do that on alcohol. What happens is you get the dregs of society that are going to get on this bandwagon and go there for the party, right? But like I just said, if they could get cannabis in their own country, they'd be the dregs of society in their country, which they're doing anyway. You know, so at least they'd be defecating in the streets of their hometown rather than going to a foreign country to do it.
Yeah, I know. And so those are the dregs of society that have enough money for a plane ticket.
Plane ticket or ferry ticket or however, their train ticket if they're coming from France or Germany. You know, the cost of travel, I'm not sure how much it is to get across borders in the European Union these days.
Just jump on a train as far as I know.
Yeah, you could get a passage pretty easily. So they're arriving in the Netherlands and they're causing problems, and then people are pointing at that and going, look at the problems caused by, you know, having legal access to cannabis. No, that's the problems caused by not having legal access to cannabis in your own country.
Yeah.
They're coming here and causing problems, you know. And if you had legal access in your own country, you could divert funds to treat those people who do have a problem, and then there'd be less of a problem.
See, it's coming back to that same old broken record again. The prohibition doesn't work, and even when you legalize in a prohibitionist world, it still is not perfect. You know,
of
you
course
need
not.
Global legalization. Ultimately, that'd be the ideal goal of this film, wouldn't it?
Well, of course. The objective of the film is to bring about a change in New Zealand policy and even globally, because people in other countries will see that New Zealand is a representative of their country and falls neatly within the framework of the United Nations imposing its prohibition on their country. Mm. And if people in New Zealand take the lead, like they claim they did, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when New Zealand was possibly a progressive society, if they could take that mantle upon themselves again and get rid of politicians like Peter Dunne and get rid of power players like Mike Sabin and have people who are talking sense like Matiria Ture decide our drug policies with our best interests at heart rather than their own interests at heart, we could take the lead and we could show other countries that this is how you regulate cannabis. This is how you control this thing.
Mm.
This is how you cause it. You take it from being a problem to being something that's beneficial for society, that can generate income, that can help people with sickness, and that can give people a safer alternative to alcohol, which is the main drug problem in this country.
I heard a statistic. I believe the government even advertises the statistic on TV. Is it 79% of all weekend crime is related to
85%
alcohol? 85%
was the statistic that I read. 85%. In the United States, not talking about weekend crime, but talking about crime in general, 30% of crimes are committed under the influence of alcohol. In New Zealand, if you're not talking about the weekend, if you're talking about the whole week, it's 40% of crimes. and this is the whopper, in the UK, 80% of crimes are committed under the influence of alcohol in the United Kingdom.
80%?
So tell us what the problem drugs are, drug warriors. And then you have Peter Dunn, who not only represents the tobacco industry in the cases that I've looked at where he's been voting in their favor. He's also representing the alcohol industry. He quashed that inquiry that was recently. He withdrew the $10,000, the measly $10,000 funding that they required to finish their study. He denied them that, so the study was never completed. And the Law Commission's advocation for tightening of the alcohol laws was basically watered down to become almost insignificant. So the booze barons are just laughing. They've got it their way almost every step of the way. And we're asking for what we're asking for in comparison is that cannabis be regulated without any advertising, right? Look at how much advertising the liquor industry sponsors. You know, aren't they sponsoring the All Blacks? They're sponsoring numerous rugby teams.
They sponsored frickin' James Bond.
Did they? Well, there you go. The alcohol industry has proliferated right through the society. We've got some of the highest rates of alcohol abuse in this country, in the world. You see it in the newspaper every day. Speaking of the All Blacks, Robin Brooks sexually assaulting a teenage girl and her teenage friend and on holiday. You know, you've got Zac Efron, what's his name? The young All Black, alcoholic, assaulting people for no reason because he's drunk. You know, this is happening all the time. You open the newspaper and there's an All Black who's committed an assault while drunk. So these are supposed to be, you know, the prime examples of, you know, New Zealand achievement, the All Blacks. Yeah, go the All Blacks. Go and assault somebody while you're drunk. Thanks very much, eh? Raise the profile of the All Blacks.
Yeah, well, it seems that alcohol is just a very massive problem in this country and many others. And it occurs to me as well, you know, what was it? There was something funny I heard the other day. Oh, yeah. It was 65% of women surveyed think that the Prime Minister of New Zealand, John Key, is sexy. And a lot of people thought, well, that's very interesting. You know, for me, it just highlighted the drinking problem that we've got in this country.
Yes, indeed. You'd have to be pretty drunk. You'd have to be pretty beer-goggled to think that the Prime Minister is sexy. He's not a sexy man.
You know, he's just got a big poster of him on the wall, and I'm just
staring
looking
at us.
You know, and he's staring at, you know, his eyes follow you wherever you
go. That's true.
You know, it's just like on Ghostbusters 2 with that painting of that old warlord dude that was real freaky and just kind of followed you around and stuff like that. That's like John Key on your wall, bro.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty disturbing.
It is disturbing.
You know, and I was just thinking about this. These people are just freaking criminals in suits. They're running the drugs. They're taking the drugs. And their inherent hypocrisy is, we're the ones who should be punished. We're the ones who should be surveilled. We're the ones who should be busted. We're the ones who should be thrown in jail. We're the ones who should be killed. We're the ones who should have our lives destroyed by their policy, which they made up off the top of their frickin' head to protect their own scumbaggery interests. They're criminals in suits. They're in parliament. They're in the government buildings. They're on the streets selling you frickin' drugs from the courthouse between sessions. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show. And we'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Talk. Divided we fall. Unity, please don't desert me.
No one's gonna take me alive. The time has come to make things right. You and I must fight.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live 5 days a week at AmericanFreedomRadio.com, 5 till 7 Central, 6 till 8 p.m. Eastern, 11 till 1 a.m. in the morning GMT time, which I believe is midnight till 2 a.m. in the European Union. And in New Zealand, the time zone switch from periodic times, you know, when we have daylight savings and what have you. At the moment, during the dead of winter, it's 10 a.m. through midday Tuesday through Saturday. So if you are capable of listening live, I implore you, please do, and do so daily, because this show will inform you about lots and lots and lots and lots of different things. This is just one show, and we're talking about cannabis, and we're uploading copious quantities of videos and things of that nature every single day. We're making sure that issues really get understood in their entire holistic nature, because nothing exists in a vacuum, nor is any man an island, as they say. This cannabis issue ties into so many, and cannabis by itself, the topic, we were talking about this over the break, Eric, is that cannabis is not technically addictive, but the study of the drug laws and the study of cannabis itself surely can be.
Well, I found that myself. My interest in the subject was pretty negligible until I started looking at it in detail. And then 4 or 5 years down the line, I've got a library full of books about hemp and cannabis. I've watched, well, I've 50 to 100, I don't know how many, documentaries about cannabis. I discover more and more on the internet all the time. It's a fascinating subject. There's so many angles that you can approach it from. Even if you have no interest in ever consuming the drug yourself, you might be thinking about building your house out of it, you know, which we're doing now, finally, in New Zealand. That little technology, which has been around for hundreds of years, and they've been doing in France, even though there was a prohibition, they continue to build houses out of cannabis in France in spite of the U.S. effort to stop that. That technology has been taken up here in New Zealand, and people are now building their house with cannabis.
Okay. It can feed you, it can clothe you, it can heal you, and it can set your mind free.
Certainly can. What do you want to talk about?
You know, I think we've kind of we've covered the subject with immense scope here. I was wondering, is there anything that we have not covered?
There are thousands of things we haven't covered. We haven't really talked about the alternative uses of cannabis. We haven't really touched upon the mystical uses of cannabis.
Let's go into the mystical uses.
Sure. Well, let's look at the sadhus in India who consume insane quantities of cannabis to reach these states of siddhartha, or whatever you want to call it. It's odd that these guys who are consuming this supposedly deadly toxic drug seem to live longer than the average person. I mean, some of them are into their 90s, the ones that I've read about. So if the drug was so deadly and they're consuming 25, 30 chilims in a row, why aren't they exhibiting any health problems from the consumption of this drug? It's because it's not toxic. That's why. I'll answer that question for you. It is a non-toxic substance. If it were toxic, it wouldn't be present in your mother's milk. It's present in breast milk. It's present in your body whether you've ever consumed the drug. You've got an endocannabinoid system. Why would your body be naturally producing exactly the same molecule inside your body if it were toxic?
Now, it's a transmutable molecule as well, isn't it? Like, it has so many different functions that it can fulfill. If you need, say, a disease to be killed or something, mm-hmm, it kills mm-hmm. it. If you need cell regeneration, like after an injury or something like that, a reduction in inflammation, it does it. It's almost like it's an intelligent being that, when imbibed, seeks out what it can improve or heal.
Well, I don't want to commit to that line of argument, but I will concur with what you said. It does seem to do what you want it to do. If you have MS, it will do it will ameliorate the condition. If you have Tourette's syndrome, it will ameliorate the condition.
Our mutual mate Barry, he's got MS.
That's
correct. And I remember we were walking up Queen Street, and I walk reasonably fast because I've got really long legs, right? And I was just cutting right ahead of him so easily, and I actually had to slow down significantly for him. And then he had a joint, and I had to run to catch up with him.
That's right. And not only that, but if we were to regulate cannabis and allow growers to differentiate between the strains that certain symptoms can be treated best with, we'd have much better outcomes than what we currently use. Currently, people with MS, they just buy what they can, and they usually buy of, you know, shady dealers who they can't trust and who may have adulterated the plant with something else to make it look more, have a higher quality and a higher price. You know, there's the reports of glass and things like that being added, you know, things to make it look crystalline. So that's thanks to the prohibition. If you could walk into a dispensary, as you can now in 18 states in the United States and in about two dozen different countries in the world, and say, I have the following symptoms, please can I have the cannabis which will give me energy if you're low in energy, or help me sleep if you have insomnia, or promote your appetite if you have AIDS wasting syndrome. And they can give you a strain that is most likely to help you, and you can experiment with the various strains to find the one that treats the problem that you have. Currently, we can't do that.
It's just dumb luck at this point.
Yeah. You might find that the shady dealer that you're going to has the right strain 1 week, and he doesn't have it the next week because maybe his supplier just got raided by the police. So, you know, for the people who really need it, where it's not a case of I just want to use it recreationally, those people are being affected the most, and they're the most vulnerable members of our society. Not only are they being deprived of access to their medicine, but they're often being deprived of their freedom. They're being deprived of their livelihood. They're being deprived of their assets. They're being deprived of their scholarships, of their jobs, contact with their family, you know, the trust of their neighbors. The list goes on. There's so many costs that are imposed on cannabis users in this country, and so many costs imposed on non-cannabis users who are footing the bill to keep this ridiculous farce going.
Now, throughout history, the Spanish, I believe, wiped out a large number of people who were, say, using mushrooms and other hallucinogens when they came into South America in order to impose their own religion upon mm-hmm. people in order to destroy the local religion. Is there a religion that's cannabis-related?
There are some religions that are based on the use of cannabis. Rastafarianism is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
In India, the sadhus. There is a lot of transcendental use of cannabis in Asia. Africa, less so. I know that that certain sangomas, certain practitioners of African healing arts in Africa use cannabis. It's called dakhade or isango is the Zulu term for it. And it's part of their tradition, and it's been heavily suppressed. You know, South Africa still has the same kind of cannabis prohibitionist mentality that's been inculcated. In fact, here's an interesting story. Speaking of racism, it's actually the historically racist South Africans that were the first ones to suggest to the League of Nations that cannabis be banned because they noticed that it was causing the Hottentots to rebel against their white masters, but they made provisos that the mine workers could use it because it seemed to increase their productivity. So you've got the hypocrisy going through at every level, and it's thanks to the racist South Africans 100 years ago that the first cannabis laws were passed, the opium treaties. Cannabis got bundled into that, into the early opium conventions, thanks to the racist South Africans.
Well, isn't that lovely?
Donkey State Africa!
Mm-hmm. It sounds about the right, mate.
Yeah.
I don't think these people who are in these positions of power really have any feeling for consequence of their actions. I mean, if I were responsible for an ill person being deprived of, say, their job or their home, or perhaps deprived of their very life itself, if they died, because of my actions, I would feel intense guilt about it and immediately reverse myself. If I were to instead go up to one of these current prohibitionists, tell them these stories, there's nothing.
You get a blank stare. You know, Peter Dunn was, when he shot down the medical amendments that was being pushed by the Green Party a couple of years back. He said a yes on this vote would mean greater access to the leaf to everyone. So no support. No, it doesn't mean greater access to anyone because people couldn't get more access to the plant right now. Anybody who wants it can get it. Okay, that's number one. And number two, no, what you're doing is you're giving a little bit of protection to the people who need it for their illness, and you're not talking about the rest of society. This is a medical bill that was being voted on. And he shot it down without blinking an eyelid. I don't think he has the capacity for empathy to recognize how much suffering he's actually caused and is still causing.
He's a freaking psychopath. That's basically my assessment of the situation.
Sociopaths in suits are the people most likely to ascend to positions of power.
Yeah, well, it's because they sabotage their competition and propel themselves forward while all the good people get left out in the cold to die. Thank you, Eric, for coming on the show with me today.
It's been a pleasure.
Druglord.com is the website, ladies and gentlemen. Please make a pledge and get him some of the funding that he needs to finish the film. We'll see you again sometime, folks.
Thanks for having me.